ever heard of the character Josephine March? Anybody know who that is? Little Women. Little Women, yes, exactly. So, yes, Josephine March is the main character of Little Women, which was set in the Civil War era in New England, and it was written by a Unitarian, Louisa May Alcott. And it's one of my favorite books. And you've had a little over a century and a half to read it, so I don't feel bad about the spoilers that are going to be in this. You may get to it still. Yeah. So Jo had three sisters, Beth, Amy, and Meg. And they grew up fairly poor in this little home with their mom, who they called Marmee. And many children play make-believe, create their own little worlds growing up, but the March sisters went above and beyond. They created their own little society within their home. And it was complete with their own newspaper, which they ran out of their playroom. And they would sit around with one another and put on these big, heavy snow boots that they imagined newspaper men would wear, and put on fake mustaches and have unlit pipes. And they'd sit sort of in a circle and say, okay, what should be in this issue? Should we give an update on the neighbor's cat? Should we write that article about why popovers should be served for every breakfast? What should be in this issue? And they would also do these amazing dramatic productions. Everyone does this a little bit. I think we'd be lying if we didn't say at one point in our life we dressed up and sang or did some kind of performance for whoever would listen. Well, the March sisters would, Jo would write a play, and then Meg would sew costumes. It would take her weeks to sew these gorgeous costumes for the sisters to wear. And then they would rehearse. They'd memorize all their lines, and weeks later put in the paper in other places that this play was going on, and they'd seat their housekeeper and their mom in the living room and do this fantastic performance. And I'll tell you that whenever I am feeling a little sad or I want to go back to my childhood innocence, this is the book that I open. You can just always feel this crackling fire and these four sisters with a warm quilt wrapped around them listening to Marmee read out loud. And you know, life was very good for a while for them when they were young, but ever so slowly, the hands of the outside world, the reality of the world, started reaching in to their tiny happy home and touching this magic world of make-believe and safety and comfort. And as you might imagine, since they grew up during the Civil War, these characters, one thing that began to creep into the minds of these little girls was the fact that their father was a chaplain in the Union Army. And as they began to understand a little bit more about what war is and the kind of danger their father was in, it was easier, you know, to smell what it might smell like after a battle, what that much blood might look like, to feel that some of the soldiers' feet were rotting because of the conditions they were in. And this reality just became more and more real in their father's letters. But there were other things that were closer to home that were starting to reach into Joe's world too. And one was that this dashing young tutor named John Brooke wanted to marry her sister Meg. And this broke Jo's heart because she saw this man as very treacherous, coming in to break up her family. And now he was a good man, as far as the book tells us. He's not treacherous, but she's right to some extent. You know, those happy days around the fire, her sister gets married and moves off a little ways and kind of breaks apart that childhood a little bit more. And then her best friend in the world, the boy across the street, they've always had adventures together, they've been best friends. He shares that he's fallen in love with her. And Jo is very confused and hurt by this because she loves him, but only as a friend. And when she has to tell him that, she loses him for a while. And then the final thing that happens as Jo is trying to find her way and grow up is that her beloved sister, her most ardent ally in all things growing up, Beth, gets sick, grows weaker, and dies. And the happy days of Jo's childhood slowly end, and the pain of it nearly swallows her whole. Each of us in our own way has known that confusing melancholy that Jo goes through growing up. The journey from childhood to adulthood is many things. It's marvelous, dizzying, and deeply painful. There's an entire genre of literature, after all, dedicated to this type of experience, this experience of coming of age, of growing up. And books in this genre tend to have as the center of their focus loss of innocence. Loss of innocence. And when we read these stories, at least for me, it always seems like innocence is something physical, like it's this precious, delicate substance that lives inside of us from the time we're born. But as we grow up, slowly these experiences we have just leach the innocence out of us. So what is innocence? Whenever you read about it in childhood literature, it seems to mean being good. Innocence means still being naive, still protected from and ignorant about the realities of the world. Innocence means being vulnerable and open and trusting. Innocence means being filled with this joy and wonder and amazement for all these things, normal things going on around you. And loss of innocence is not only a theme in literature, it's a theme in theology, too. One example is some of the work done by Christian theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And now, aside from being an excellent theologian, Bonhoeffer is a man of deep integrity and compassion, and he deserves his own sermon series. It's not going to happen today. But for now, just know this about him. While being held in jail by the Nazis during World War II, Bonhoeffer wrote a series of letters to his dear ones, thinking more deeply about his own faith and the current state of religion. And in his letter from June 8, 1944, Bonhoeffer wrote that the world had come of age. People were becoming increasingly independent from God. People no longer need a God in the traditional ways of old. As Bonhoeffer put it, man has learnt to deal with himself and all questions of importance without recourse to the working hypothesis called God. In questions of science, art, and ethics, it is becoming evident that everything gets along without God, and in fact, just as well as before. Bonhoeffer explores in this series of letters what religion and faith will look like in this world come of age, this world that has lost its childlike, innocent acceptance of God's authority. Just as Jo's heart ached as the world she knew slipped away and she had to accept her own adulthood, Bonhoeffer wrote pages and pages proposing how religion might get its bearings in this world come of age. Now, Unitarian Universalists have often been the leaders, the people really trying to nudge the world toward coming of age. Our forebears brought science and philosophy into our faith on purpose, seeing the discoveries of science and reason not as threats, but just new, exciting forms of revelation. And in the realm of social justice, our forebears embraced the modern idea at the time that slavery was evil, that women should have a right to vote. And they embraced these things long before the archaic norms of society said they were okay. And today, Unitarian Universalists continue to try to help society grow up. We embrace LGBTQ equality, and our denomination has officially made a statement recognizing climate change as a reality. We're all for helping the world come of age. Except that in my experience, Unitarian Universalists are among those who refuse to surrender, to give up all of our innocence. Innocence means that our hearts are more vulnerable, our minds are more open to wonder and possibility. When we still have our innocence, we believe life is basically good. We believe people are basically good. And in my experience, Unitarian Universalists carry some portion of their innocence inside of them their entire life long. I think this is true not only of Unitarian Universalists today, but it would seem to be true of UUs throughout history. Now, it would be very silly to think that our forebears didn't lose some of their innocence on their spiritual journeys through life. I imagine that Clara Barton was disappointed and saddened and momentarily defeated at times as she tried to bring the first public education system to New Jersey, or helping wounded on the battlefield during the Civil War, or creating the Red Cross. I imagine that Egbert Ethelred Brown had many times when he wanted to give up, when he was told repeatedly in the 1920s by Unitarians and non-Unitarians that he would never be able as a black man to start or lead a Unitarian church. But he did. And I imagine that Lydia Maria Child got countless letters filled with disgust and hate when she published a novel in 1824 about the love affair between an American Indian and a white woman, and she made this American Indian man complex and have layers of his character. He became fully human. And people did not like that. Picture the way people troll on the internet today and write nasty things. I just imagine the snail mail letters Lydia Maria Child must have gotten in her time. But she didn't give up. In fact, a few years later, she went on to write a book on abolition. But you can't do the kinds of things that our forebears have done without holding on to some portion of your innocence. That's something within that keeps our hearts vulnerable, our minds open to wonder. That's something within us that keeps alive our optimism about life and the goodness of humanity. In the end of Little Women, even Josephine March, even though she had watched everyone she loved grow up, even though she had lost her sister, even though she lived during the Civil War, her innocence was never fully lost. Jo had to have her heart broken. She had to lose her way a few times. But her innocence was never lost. She just had to remember that it was still there. She had to learn to listen to her innocence again. And this is what I see my brother and sister, Unitarian Universalists, doing. You keep listening to your innocence. And it doesn't happen often in my experience, but there have been times in my life when someone outside of the Unitarian Universalist faith has belittled my faith for this reason. And in these moments, someone always presents me with arguments about why my faith is less valid or less relevant than theirs. And the main issue always seems to be this flimsy idealism or shallow cheerfulness they perceive Unitarian Universalists to have. An untethered core, not tied to any one text or one creed. What authority do we have to hope? What can we point to ground our idealism, our seemingly naive worldview? As you know, kind of the difficult part of this faith is that each of you has to figure out your own answer to that question. But I'm going to share mine, what I point to for my authority, for knowing there is cause for hope, for knowing there is cause to keep my heart vulnerable and my mind open. I point to the lives of human beings. Because all human beings can find ample cause to be world weary, to allow their innocence to evaporate, to be leached out by the experience of life. All human beings can find cause to feel depleted rather than satisfied at the end of the day. Everyone can find cause for despair if they look hard enough. But through my living and working with Unitarian Universalists, I find a people who look life and human nature square in the face and choose hope every time. Not because it's easier to choose hope. It's not easier to have empathy or keep your mind open to wonder. We have to work hard to keep our optimism and our idealism strong. We have to work hard to keep our hope and our innocence potent. We have to work at keeping our hearts vulnerable and our minds open. Holding on to our innocence takes a lot of work. But I believe that each of you continues to be up to the task, and I hope you believe that I am too. So let us hold on to our innocence, nourish it, and fiercely protect it. Blessed be. Amen.